The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
One fine morning, I was awakened. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. One fine morning, I was awakened to find the fascists at my door. Oh, partigiano, take me with you. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Partigiano, please take me with you. I don't feel frightened anymore.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Fighting Fascism podcast. I'm your co-host, Aaron Regenberg, and here today with the lovely Matt DeSilva.
Wow.
And the fans have been
clamoring
for his return. Friend of the pod, Jonathan Smucker.
Friend of the pod, I'm here in the house. I need to work on my signature sound effect, but
it's good to have you back. How's dissertation writing going for you?
It's fun. It's actually quite fun, but also maybe one of the most stressful things I've ever experienced. The deadlines. It's kind of weird having spent a life in politics where I feel like this is the most pressure I've ever experienced for something. It makes no sense. Like the least is at stake, but I think it's because in politics, you're like working with a team. You're like, you know, a lot of people are responsible and this is just such a solitary thing. So yeah, that's how it's gone.
Working by yourself seems hard.
Yeah. It's like, it's fun in moderation. Dissertation right. is not moderation.
No.
Yeah. I miss my kids. I miss you guys.
In what order?
In the order listed, yeah.
Well, I'm not working on anything of note. In case anyone's wondering, status quo over here.
And anyone's putting on a theatrical production.
Yeah. In case anyone's got a job
open
for me.
Open to work.
Open to work. Yeah, no, I actually just attended a reading of, it was fun, we did a reading of a new musical in my friend's living room last night, which is, it's like very much in development and it's cool. It's like the coolest part of the process where you just get to watch your friends create a piece of art and then take part of it and read the words and I had this moment, and then we talked about it for an hour afterwards. I just had this moment where I was looking at my friend who wrote the music and being like, God damn, you wrote this. That's so cool. It was just a nice, weird, kind of corny moment of like, wow, there are so many talented people in the world, and it's crazy that we get to work with them sometimes. Anyway. That's my reflection.
I love that. I want to watch the musical. Yeah, I mean, yeah. This is the last generation where we'll still be writing them ourselves.
Boo. I think you guys will like it. It's like a spy thriller musical, kind of a like if you took like James Bond and made it even campier and turned it into a musical. It's really fun.
Wow.
Ugh, I've seen so many of those James Bond campy spy thriller musicals. I don't know if we really need another of those.
Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm good. For longtime listeners, we'll know the valence of this, but we have gone cold turkey on feeding our baby mulberries. So things have been a little more manageable on that front.
took a drastic turn.
Well, folks, we have just a real barn burner of an episode for you today with one of the coolest people around. Sarah Nelson is our guest. She is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants. One of the most dynamic, outspoken labor leaders in the country today. And it was awesome to, that she gave us some of her time to share her thoughts on the state of organized labor in this moment, the role of organized labor in standing up to authoritarianism, what unions are doing vis-a-vis the Democratic Party right now. Lots of good stuff.
It's so nice when labor celebs make time for their fans. I feel like it was so great to talk to her, though, actually.
Yeah, she's a real one.
Not a lot of like hard critical pushback from us in this episode,
because no, it's kind of hard when you're over here.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a little bit that SNL sketch where it's like, tell me about that. That was cool. Yeah.
Remember that
Chris Farley?
That was awesome. Yeah.
But no, I mean, she talks about her story of how she got into being the president of the Flight Attendants Union, and just like, you know, coming up from a rank and file worker to being president of the union. She's just like a kind of a natural leader. And I think found her, we're lucky that she found this avenue for it. And I think we're going to be, I think the United States labor movement needs 10 more Sarah Nelsons and 10 fewer Sean O'Briens if we're gonna build the future that I want to see.
It just struck me just beyond the substance. And, you know, we've talked about this with Mamdani too, about like what are some of the non-substantial things that are so great about him. And it's just like, he gives a fuck. And it's the same with talking with her. It's like, you can see how much she cares about this. You can see that come through, and it's such a quality of leadership that's so important
and unseen in so many of our leaders.
Yeah,
it's a great conversation, folks. You should listen to it now. Well, welcome Sarah Nelson to the Fighting Fascism podcast. We are so excited to have you.
So excited to be here. I just finished watching Andor, so I feel like it's perfect timing.
Hell yeah.
Amazing. The best Star Wars.
The best. Yes.
Such a good encapsulation of the world right now. Well, it's awesome to see you again. I think the last time I saw you in person was when you came to Rhode Island to give a truly electrifying speech here. It was wonderful to see you then, and it's great to see you again now. You were reelected earlier this year to serve your fourth term as president of the Association of Flight Attendants. First of all, congratulations. And to start, it'd be great to just hear a little bit about sort of your story. Like, how did you get here? You know, tell us a little bit about yourself, your work in the labor movement, and what your journey has been.
So the last thing in the world that I ever thought I'd be doing would be running a union. In fact, I didn't really even know anything about unions growing up, even though in Oregon, my mom was a member of NEA as a teacher, and we got most of our benefits through that union contract. And my dad went to school to be a physical education teacher, but Oregon passed tax cuts, property tax cuts that cut school budgets, and suddenly there were no jobs. And so he made his way in the lumber industry, and I ended up, you know, they gave us a great life. And my mom always said that, and we didn't have a lot of money, but she said, money are for experiences, not things. And so we would travel a lot, even if it was in the family station wagon with all the camping gear and my brothers and I wrestling in the back seat. But anyway, pretty wholesome upbringing. And then I went to school in Southern Illinois and decided that I was going to follow in my mother's footsteps and become a teacher, and was planning to do that, teaching high school English. And when I finished my college degree, I had to do my student teaching in the fall, and my best friend became a flight attendant, sort of on a lark. She was house sitting for someone who was a family of United employees, United Airlines employees. And they said, hey, United Airlines is hiring. We thought it was hilarious, but she called me. We didn't know anything about it, but she called me about 8 months later when I was working four jobs after my student teaching, waiting for my full-time teaching assignment in the fall. So I was subbing, I was working in a home store, I was working for a temp agency, filing for a healthcare insurance company, by the way, learned a lot there with the very thick files, denied, and saw that people had to be very persistent to get their healthcare covered. And also waiting tables, and everyone should wait tables. I think it's a required course for every human being. But anyway, I was really working hard, and I started to get the student loan bills and was kind of freaking out about how I was going to be able to make ends meet on a first year teacher's salary, setting up my classroom in inner city St. Louis, trying to make it a place where students could learn, and really kind of freaking out about the whole thing. When I got a call from my friend who was at Miami Beach with her toes in the sand, and the first thing she said was that I'm in my bikini, ha ha ha, courtesy of United Airlines, and really razzed me. It was a snowy day in February in St. Louis. But then the call turned serious, and she said, actually, this job is no joke. And she described the union contract that had been negotiated over 6 years. She did not put it in those terms, but she talked about the pay, which was going to be more than my first year teacher pay. We should talk about that, too. she talked about the healthcare that had been negotiated by women. She talked about the flexibility on the job, and she talked about the pension that I would be able to take at age 50. And our moms were both 50 at that time, super young, super energetic. And I thought, well, hell, you know, if I wanted to have a second job, I could do that too. So that pension, ironically, while I was working those four jobs at 23, is what made me get in my car and drive to Chicago the next day to apply with United Airlines. And I got the job. United sent me to Boston after 7 weeks of unpaid training. And my parents were not necessarily super happy that I had taken this very expensive liberal arts school education and decided to do something totally unrelated. They were happy 6 months later when they got the free flight benefits. But I started my career in Boston, and we got an apartment, seven of us, crammed into a little apartment, two stops on the subway from the airport. And my union contract gave me a subway card so I could get around the T in Boston, and started on my flying career. And I had no money in my pockets. We were waiting for that first paycheck to drop, and my roommates got their first paycheck, and I was so excited to call. And I called up, and there was $12 in my bank account. So I went into the office and I asked somebody if they could help me with this. And they said, well, you get your first paycheck at different times for different reasons. We're sure you get it next time. And I just remember playing in my head, like, mind your P's and Q's on probation. They can let you go if there's a hair out of place. But I was kind of freaking out and got real close with Top Ramen over the next couple of weeks, and begged for assignments so I could eat some plain food. And got through to the next paycheck day. And I actually came home the night before. You want to talk about working class solidarity. The van drivers for the hotel would take the crews, the out of town crews, to the hotel, and then they would drive the local flight attendants home. What a deal.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, I was getting out of it, and the custom was to give a dollar to the van driver for taking your bag out of the van. And all I had was a quarter. So this is the most pathetic story, but I literally only had a quarter left to my name, and I gave it to him, and he was like, sure, lady, whatever. And I went into the house. There's nobody else home, the apartment, and nothing to eat in the cupboard. So the next morning, while I was waiting for that paycheck to drop, I actually went back to the airport with my contract provided T-pass and jump seated to Chicago and back so I could eat while I was waiting for the paycheck to drop. And when I got back, I checked my bank account, and there was still nothing there. So rent's due the next day. People are counting on me. I went down into the office and said, somebody's really got to help me. There's really something wrong. I didn't get my paycheck again. And they said, well, you get your first paycheck at different times for different reasons. And I was suddenly like, you've got to be kidding. You're not listening to me. And it was the first time that I felt like a number in an HR file. And then I got a little too excited for someone on probation. And the tears started to roll because I just didn't know what I was going to do. And I had this tap on the shoulder and I turn around. There's someone standing there who looks a lot like me, but I'd never seen her before. I do remember her union pin right above her wings. And she was holding her checkbook and asking me how to spell my name. And she wrote me a check for $800. And she said, number one, you go take care of yourself. And number two, you call our union. And I did call our union. I had my paycheck the very next day. But I always tell everyone that I learned everything that I needed to know in that moment. Because in our unions, we're never alone. And through our unions, we can organize the care that we have for one another to get the most out of it. So the union called me and said, hey, would you like to get involved? And I said, yes, I'll do the new hire presentations. This shouldn't happen to anyone else. And so got very involved. And then we negotiated a contract I thought stunk. And so I became a dissident in the union, wanted to change the union. People kept asking me to do the next thing, the next thing. I got a lot of experience in the union because I apparently, you know, a strong sense of justice and a loud mouth will carry you really far. But Aaron, what really happened was that 5 years later, 9/11 hit. And I lost my friends on a flight that I flew very often, Amy and Michael and Amy, Catherine, Al, Robert, Alicia, Marianne, and Jesus. And I say their names almost every single day because while we were grieving our friends, there were crisis capitalists planning to use that moment to redefine the value of a flight attendant, a pilot, a mechanic, a gate agent, labor costs of the entire industry, just like they had done in other industries. And I learned that very painfully later, but it's a lesson that I learned over the next 3 years fighting in a bankruptcy to try to hang on to that pension that made me drive to Chicago in the first place, which we lost. But because we fought, we cut the amount that they took in executive bonuses. We doubled the amount they wanted to pay for a pension replacement plan. We saved retiree health care. And we fought like hell to try to save the job and the career that had been built up by union members over the years. But I learned something very valuable, and that gave me the tools to want to fight for working people, because I learned very close and personal that capitalism is a horror for human beings. And if it's not for unions, we don't have a chance at all as the working class.
That's such a amazing origin story. With so many ups and downs and twists and turns. Ultimately, like, just such a great example of what, you know, the labor movement can do and can be. I come from a family, my parents are both public school teachers. And so, you know, similarly, I think, I grew up in a place in Rhode Island where there's a lot of, you know, labor solidarity to an extent. And I think kind of take it for granted in some cases that, like, we had a lot of friends and family who were union people. I'm now an actor and I'm involved with my union and union governance as well and everything. So a lot of what you're saying also personally resonates. And all that said, can you tell us a bit? We're going to kind of jump into the larger labor movement in general for a bit here. Can you give us a little bit of a recap, casual question here, the story of organized labor over the last 50 years and sort of like where we were 50 years ago or 60 years ago, whatever, and where we are now and sort of, you know, your vision of what's happened?
Just an easy question for you.
Just a casual, you know.
Simple question, yeah.
Books have been written, but if you could do it in like a minute, that'd be great.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no problem. No, I mean, you have to go back 100 years to look at the national strikes and general strikes and sit-down strikes that formed the labor movement in the first place and gave FDR the power to be able to sign into law the New Deal. That comes from working people joining in their unions. And it was after that. And frankly, there was so much disruption that capital was begging for labor law just to have some stability. That's the kind of position that we need to put them in to deal with us fairly. And so after that, we built up our unions, had that labor law, were able to organize and grow the density of the labor movement in order to put that check on capital. They fought really, really hard to try to destroy unions. passed Taft-Hartley made it possible for states to pass laws that are right to work, which are just about weakening union power.
Right to work for less.
Right to work for less is exactly the correct title for it. But then that got supercharged when Ronald Reagan fired the air traffic controllers almost 50 years ago. And he sent a message to corporate America that it was open season on unions. There had already been an attack. The labor movement had already been on the decline. But that is really what supercharged it, made unions a dirty word, made the strike a dirty word. People were afraid to say that. And that led to a lot of company business unionism and this idea that labor peace is what we're all striving for, but labor peace is only really good for management. There always has to be a struggle in order to keep that in check. So when he fired those 13,000 air traffic controllers and sent some of them to jail, that is what really set off a real attack on labor to where we are today. And what the bosses have tried to say is that you should feel lucky to have a job. And what I have said more recently, and you talk about the last 50 years, that has been the mantra. But as workers are starting to understand that, no, everything is against us and we're going to have to fight for everything that we need, there has started to be more strike activity. There's started to be a fight back. And what I've said is for the next 50 years, we're going to make them feel lucky to have our work. And if people could wake up to that notion, we could really change the dynamics here and set the agenda. Because the fact of the matter is that we all know that this country was built on the idea that it was for the people and of the people, by the people. And we've never really made good on that promise. And the only way that we're going to do that is to actually give people power. And the only way that people have power is really to organize in their workplaces, take on that capital that's trying to choke out our politics, choke out our constitution, and ultimately do away with it. And that's why we've been on the road to fascism, because the political parties are not going to do that for us. We've decided that we were going to put all of our efforts into electing the right people. Well, if you don't have the people power behind them to be able to say no to the corporate money that controls them, then we're never going to have a political system that works for working people. So that's where we are today. That's why we are where we are today. And that's why we have to organize like never before and like they did in the 30s to build up that kind of working class power that it will take to reverse the massive inequality that is in place today.
And we're going to definitely, given the theme of this podcast, be picking up the thread on fascism here in a bit. But a little more on the state of the labor movement. So, and the state of working class people in the United States. So 70% of Americans say they would like to be part of a labor union. And yet the percentage of unionized workers is presently at risk of dipping even below, you know, into the single digits potentially. So what are some of the most important factors explaining this discrepancy? I know some of it's in the history you already talked about, the PATCO strike, et cetera, but what are some of the biggest factors explaining this? And most importantly, what do we do about it right now in the year 2026?
Okay. So coupled with the firing of the air traffic controllers was also a financialization of our economy. So moving to, you know, making stock buybacks legal, moving towards quarterly earnings calls that have executives only thinking about those short-term decisions and how they can stuff as much money into shareholders' pockets as opposed to running a good business. The easiest attack on costs in a company is labor costs. So they've come after those labor costs. And we have to fight back against that. But as the union as the number of people in unions has shrunk, so has our ability to be able to organize. Organizing is expensive. And when you have fewer unions to be able to devote time to do that organizing, you have lesser ability to be able to meet that demand of the public who want unions. The other thing that we have allowed ourselves to do is to think that the labor movement is only the people who have a union card already in their pocket. And we have to start thinking bigger, open our arms wider, and understand that an injury to one really is an injury to all. And so we have to fight really, really hard to put that union in the hands of everyone and to talk about and visualize and make it the foundation of everything we do, that the labor movement is every single working person who wants a union, not just the people who have it today. So that's how we have to approach it in our minds. We also have to help people understand that we hear a lot of times about the rich and powerful, but they don't really have power. The true power comes from our labor. Nothing moves without working people. And if we understand that and wake up to our power and wake up to sharing that together and break through the fear of the union busting that tries to keep us apart and tries to keep us down, tries to keep us from organizing, then we can exercise that power and take back control, which will allow us to take back our money and our time that they've stolen from us. So that's what needs to happen. But I will tell you that the current labor movement, even if they spent every single dollar that they have on union organizing, it would not meet the demand that is necessary today. So if there's people out there who want to see a world that actually is more fair, that tackles inequality and allows us to create the political power that we need to get the things that we need for people, like healthcare as a human right with Medicare for all, like housing for everyone, decent housing for everyone, a good job for everyone, the ability to take on the climate crisis in a way that creates an economy for everyone, the ability to make sure that these tech bros are not running away with everything and programming AI to take over our lives rather than actually work for us, then we have to raise a ton of money. And I just launched a nonprofit called Union Now that people can contribute to. You, if you want to check it out, it's at unionnow.org. And the idea behind this is that we're going to supplement the organizing that's going on out there. And we have to support those big campaigns, the campaign at Amazon. We have to support the campaign at Tesla. We have to support the campaign at Delta Airlines. And the biggest obstacle to people organizing is that because they have extracted so much of our time and taken so much of our money, made us work harder for less, people don't have time to organize. So if we can help working people put money in their pockets to be able to have the time to actually organize their unions, we're gonna organize a lot faster. And that's what Union Now is set up to do. It's also set up to support workers who may be retaliated against illegally, help support them if they're fired while they're waiting for that to be heard in any kind of adjudication, which usually takes a long time. And also support workers who are striking for a first contract, because we've got to lock those in. You can't just organize the union. It's this whole long process. And if we don't put power behind that and recognize that everybody's got to chip into this, because everyone benefits when more people have a union and a union contract.
So much in there. We could have like a whole different just labor nerd conversation, but and we got to skip to the authoritarianism, but
yeah.
You know, because that's
Matt, just stuff, real quick, but listeners, so Google Union Now and check it out.
And before we move on to the conversation, a few things I want to follow up there. So I was at the AFL-CIO convention a week or two ago in Minneapolis as a alternate delegate with the Actors Equity Association. Really great experience, 3 or 4 days. I was explaining to people it's like a big pep rally for the labor movement with a lot of really inspiring stuff and kind of a recommitment to our values. I will say the one thing that jumped out to me in a few things, but like one of the biggest glaring omission from the like 3 or 4 days was the lack of a commitment to Medicare for All. And to me, it feels like the like, maybe this is too stark of a term, but it feels like the moral failure of the current labor movement that we are not totally on board. My union, Actors Equity Association, has called for Medicare for All. We're a tiny little, 50,000 person outfit. I know you guys are also on board. What do we need to do to get that to be a unified thing for the labor movement?
We need to organize more people. That's just the fact of the matter. We can't allow those conversations to take place just inside of a convention hall that isn't even broadcast anywhere. I mean, I'm not sure that it really matters what was said in that room, because it wasn't heard anywhere. So as far as I'm concerned, we're going to be with the people, because the vast majority of people in this country want Medicare for All. The vast majority of people in this country want unions. And that's where the power is to get it. So we're going to keep talking about it. And I would not say that I don't really know why that wasn't a defined priority for at the AFL-CIO convention. It should be. I think that the people who have maybe been opposed before, that opposition is going away. And we have to be really clear. I mean, we can't be afraid to stand for what is really necessary. We have to understand where the idea of Medicare for All came from. I mean, obviously, this is already in place in every other developed country around the world. Mm-hmm. But it also came from Walter Reuther. And the United Auto Workers saying to the big three, let's go to Washington together and get health care for all and pensions for all. And that will help the companies, too. And their response to Walter Reuther was, well, it sounds too much like socialism to us, so we're not going to do that. And he said, fine, I'll take it from you in contract bargaining. And they did, and they set that as a standard. But what we have to remember is that most times things that we get in union contracts are just the spark of what we will eventually get as a right or as a law that covers all citizens. And we're just not done with this work. So this was defined as a priority by the labor movement a long time ago. Whether or not people are willing to say that full-throatedly now, I think is a mistake. But I don't think it's gone away. And the vast majority of unions support it. The vast majority of people support it. And we should be very clear that this is a priority for labor.
Cool.
Hell yeah. So moving on a bit to sort of the role of unions in standing up to fascism. Want to get your thoughts both historically and now. You already talked a bit about the central role organized labor played in making the New Deal happen. And we've talked a lot in this show about how, you know, the New Deal was sort of self-consciously organized as a program to head off the growing threat of fascism in the United States that was playing out after the Great Depression. Sort of briefly, what's your sense of the role of labor in fighting authoritarianism? And right now in this moment where we have, right-wing wannabe authoritarians in control of our federal government, what are sort of the major strategic dilemmas that puts to the labor movement when it comes to this moment?
Well, fundamentally, I always say this, that whenever we are tackling a problem, we need to think about it as a formula. The first thing you have to do is define the problem. Next, you set your demands, back up those demands with what you're willing to do, and you add urgency, okay? This moment certainly calls for urgency. That's sort of taken care of for us. But when I talk about defining the problem, what that means is that in our unions, we can actually have those discussions. This is the place where Americans trust unions more than they trust either political party, than they trust even regular mainstream media. They trust, this is a space where we can actually define these problems together. And if the working class understands what is a problem, then it's easy then to set our demands together and to be united around fixing it. So it really starts with this, Aaron, I would say. I mean, it's extraordinary that journalists have organized so much over the last decade. But of course, our journalism is being torn apart. It is being bought up. The message is being controlled by the oligarchs who are already in control. So first and foremost, union halls, union organizing, this is the place where we can define these problems together as a working class, talk about that, talk about the realities of it, and then set our demands to fix it. So I think that is first and foremost labor's priority is to have those discussions, to not just be having them in private discussions, in private rooms, and or just in a union convention. You got to take that out and talk with all of the members in the union or all of the people who are trying to organize into the union. And then, when you define those problems and people really understand it and understand what the attacks are, that also puts people on the same page. When they start to get into a room to talk about common demands, they also start to hear each other's stories, how these things are affecting them. And then you start to connect with people. You can't help but do that. And that's the kind of solidarity that has to be built to take on fascism and be ready to get into the streets together, deny our labor as a part of a system that is moving more and more towards authoritarianism. So what I'm talking about, of course, is leading towards the idea of a general strike. And you know, I think people throw that around as a term that is easy to say. And people will sort of laugh it off for that reason, or they'll say that it's too hard. We have so much organizing to do to be able to do that. But what I know, and in my experience, is that when you really define a problem and people understand that they're not alone in that, that the solidarity that is built and the ability to fight back, just understanding that you're not doing it alone, can happen very quickly, can come together in an instant almost. And so unions have to continue to build towards that. I would say that also we have to, when we're talking about defining those problems, we have to talk about defining the problem of the attack on immigrants, and which is really an attack on Black and brown people. It is really an attack on women. It is an effort to put in place the union busters 4Ds, divide, delay, distract, and demoralize. It's about demoralizing the people that they are treating as less than human. It's about dividing us and making us feel like if we keep our heads down, maybe we won't be seen. Or they're attacking people who don't look like us, so maybe that's not our problem. These are all of the tactics, and you can see them everywhere, those 4Ds. And if you identify that, then that's something as a union member and as just a human being living here, that if you see that going on, you got to counter that with solidarity. So we've got to spread the message of solidarity like never before and understand that those attacks are coming to our door next. So the people who stood out on the streets and defended immigrants and people of color during Metro Surge, they're coming after them now, and they are indicting them. And they are calling them troublemakers and trying to say that they're going to send those people to jail. This will only continue to step forward if we don't understand that each one of these attacks is an attack on all of us. And so that's what the labor movement has to inspire. And that has to start, you know, that can't just start with that big idea. That's a lot for people to take in. But if you can start with people are seeing and experiencing right in their daily lives and what they care about, you build that trust, you build that relational organizing across the board, you build that solidarity, and you can build those connections. Because oftentimes when you start to bring these things into the workplace, people have personal experiences with these issues and bring that to other people. And there can be connections made there that are not possible when you just try to hope that people will read on their own or learn mm-hmm. these things on their own.
And it seems to me, some of what's under the surface of what you're talking about, one of the strategic dilemmas that Aaron asked about is, a lot of union members support Trump, right? I mean, I know that they're, and I know it varies for different unions, but in both 2016 and 2024 and 2020, there were major dilemmas that I privy to in unions about how to engage with the elections, how to engage in the moment, because they're doing internal polling and finding these big sympathies. How did that happen? And what do we do about that? How do you take that as a constraint and not be paralyzed about it? Because I've seen paralysis by some unions where it's like, oh, well, what can we do? This is where our base is at, and kind of accepting that, but not talking about it. Yeah, I'm curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is, look, I know what this is like in a contract campaign. So I'll give you an example. One of the major carriers that our union represented, the flight attendants had a major carrier. Those flight attendants had been co-paired with the pilots. Their contract said that they get everything that the pilots get, okay? Now that worked for a really long time until the pilots started deciding, you know what, we don't really need this work role, so we're gonna negotiate that away. And then all of a sudden the flight attendants lost it without ever having a say at the table. They also were sort of, you know, giving away their power, because when they were flying under the same rules as the pilots, they would expect that the captain was going to enforce the the rules of the contract, and that didn't have them practicing standing up for their own rights. So we had a contract go down by 80 to 20%, like massive turnout, okay? Because because it had a decoupling with the co-pairing of the pilots. And we had to do an education campaign. We couldn't just say, oh, well, that's okay. Like, they don't want it, so we'll just give in to that. No, it was wrong. We knew it was wrong. We knew it was bad for our members. We knew that we had to do something about it. So we went about a huge education campaign to talk about the problems with this, why we needed to stand on our own. And guess what? 11 months later, essentially the same contract was put before the same group, and it was voted in, this time 80-20. So we just can't be afraid to take these things on. And the other thing that I would just say is that because we have become so dependent upon electoral politics, as opposed to understanding where our power is and focusing on building that power in our workplaces and taking the money from the corporations, so frankly, also so they don't have it to spend on politics, we have been outsourcing our power to politicians, just like that. I think of it as the metaphor, the flight attendants who are willing to outsource their power to the captain to enforce their rights. And that got undercut because they didn't understand them themselves or understand their power themselves. So we have to really, you know, change our mindset here and dig in and do the hard work of organizing and help people connect to these issues and also take it away from the electoral politics. If you think about that, like, I never say the president's name. I don't, because it is a trigger. And when you talk about issues and policies that the president is putting forward or his administration is putting forward, a lot of times, you know, you'll hear Fox News talking points, or you'll just hear a knee-jerk reaction to that. If you talk about those policies and take the personalities out of it, everyone seems to be on the same page. They all seem to believe that corporations shouldn't be controlling our politics. They all seem to believe that corporations have too much power. They all seem to believe that the tech oligarchs are choking us all out, and that the yachts are getting bigger and bigger, and a rising tide is not lifting all boats. It's only lifting the yachts. And actually, if we understand that we're not the boats, we're the tide, and we can overthrow those yachts if we really understand where the tide, then we can get somewhere. So, you know, I just think that that's what we have to do. We have to dig in. Just because something's hard doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. In fact, it probably means that we need to dig in and do it more.
So love that. And love that the we are the tide line. This is kind of, that was sort of the perfect, or rather the sort of opposite worst possible segue into this. Mm-hmm. You're talking about how we need to move away from electoral politics. We do want to ask you a little bit on some electoral politics stuff.
That's fine. It's necessary. I'm just saying it shouldn't be our center. That's all.
Yes, and related to that, I guess my first question is, you know, there is an insurgency playing out right now in the Democratic Party. You've got populists and progressives and democratic socialists challenging longtime corporatist incumbents across the country. We know that when the labor movement wants to, it can play a really defining role in these fights, right? And we've seen that, I think, most recently in Maine. Unions there were extremely upset with Janet Mills for, you know, fucking them over one too many times. And so they by and large threw down with Graham Plattner. That felt so remarkable, I think, because it isn't the norm. And in most of these progressive challenge circumstances, it feels like most of labor aligns with the Democratic establishment. And very often it feels like labor leaders function as and even think of themselves as part of that Democratic establishment, even when that, you know, corporatist establishment has been pretty awful to labor in a lot of instances. So would love to hear your analysis on that dynamic. And I'm sure there are important good reasons, whether it's membership exposure or others, for folks to be making some of those decisions. But given that, what will it take to get more of labor to be willing to push back against this decrepit, failing in the pocket of billionaires party establishment that has gotten us where we are today?
So, you know, the phrase, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. I think that a lot of people have internalized that as though we need access, we need to be in the room. And if we just get in the room, then we're a part of the discussion. Well, that's not really true. I think the disrespect for labor and the dismissal of labor in the Democratic Party has become, and I say the Democratic Party because, you know, that was traditionally where the support for labor resided, going back to FDR. Okay. I also want to be very clear that we have to hold Republicans accountable too. This is, it's across the board. You have to hold everyone accountable. And sometimes people forget that. But I don't really also care whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. Like, they answer to us, and that's the kind of posture that we need to take. I think that a lot of times people go to that access politics as opposed to understanding that we need to be in a position of power. A lot of people think that power is a limited resource, but using power builds power. And understanding that, and understanding that you're going to keep demanding. It's not like I'm going to make this demand, and so I'm not going to be able to make that one. So maybe I should keep this demand in my pocket for when I need it. No, if you make a demand, guess what? They know every time you come, you're going to come with expectations. And you're also going to come with accountability. And so it's just changing that posture, frankly, to understand that we actually do have power. And I have said this a lot in a lot of different ways, but Mayor Mamdani said it, you know, so beautifully, and I may not get his words exactly right, but he said the only majority in this country is the working class. And we understand that we can set the agenda, not think of labor as the appendage. And that is what I experienced so many times, is that, oh, we're going to talk about the labor provisions in USMCS. Well, no, our trade should be about labor. Our trade should be about how this is going to help our communities and working people everywhere, not just jobs. I'm talking about overall. Jobs have to be fundamental, but it has to be about creating a policy that is for working people. Medicare for all is for working people. It is for humanity. And so this is the problem, I think. And this is also what we're seeing and why there's so much energy around Democratic Socialists who are running, people who are running against the establishment, people who are running as independents like Dan Osborne. You know, they're cutting a different path, and they're cutting a path for labor, and they're not being apologetic about it. Claire Valdez being very clear about who she is, who she stands for, and where she comes from, and not being afraid to say that. And she's not even like this forceful speaker, but she just doesn't stop. I call it being unapologetically Claire. It's great.
I'm voting for her later this afternoon. That's my district.
Awesome. So let's go Claire. But, you know, and there's a lot of examples of that all over the country. You're right. And this is what people are hungry for. I went to Maine, actually. It's funny you bring up Maine. I went to Maine for Labor Day I think it was 2019. And I got to, I spent the whole weekend driving all over Maine for Labor Day. And we talked about this. We talked about the fact that, you know, this was our world to win. And it was a great labor movement who was ready, who was saying that they were hungry for leadership. They were hungry for that kind of leadership. And I think that that's what we're seeing all over this country, is that working people are starved for leadership. And it leaves room for terrible leaders to take the helm, just because they're saying, I'm going to fix it for you because no one else has. And that, it's that simple. And so if we understand that we can just do a little bit more, and actually a lot more, to set an agenda that actually resonates with people and talk with people. Reverend Barber tells this great story about going to Macomb County just before Andy Beshear was first elected, and that with the Poor People's Campaign. And the Poor People's Campaign was only talking about issues. They were not talking about politics. But here they are in Macomb County, went massively for Trump in 2016. And he was talking to a guy with the last name McCoy. So as he says, he was the real McCoy. But he said, you know, we know Trump is shit, but he came here and he talked to us. And then his staff came back and talked to us again. And then he came back here again. And we haven't seen a Democrat since LBJ. And that's what I'm also talking about when I say we can't just, you know, cast aside these red states or red counties. There's working class people there who are dying for this leadership, and we got to bring it to them.
We talk about it a lot here in Central Pennsylvania. It's both how you talk, but also just which voters you're showing up and talking to. You know, here in Central Pennsylvania, where, you know, we've been organizing in areas that for 50, 60 years, progressive forces between labor unions, the Democratic Party, community organizing, it dropped off over those 50 years. So even just showing up, saying anything, makes a difference. So on this question of the working class, you know, finally, since the 2024 election, you've got some in Democratic Party leadership doing what should have been immediately apparent after 2016, which is starting to reckon on some level with how the party has functionally become a party of affluent people in, you know, roughly the top 20%, highly educated cultural elites, the severity of the bleed of working class voters out of the party is finally starting to sink in. However, in the discourse about this, about winning back the working class, it often feels like the image people have is of the, you know, exclusively white male section of industrial labor from about 75 to 100 years ago. And this like operates also as cover for, well, because of that, you know, we want to talk about winning the working class. Let's start by throwing, you know, vulnerable groups under the bus.
Yeah.
Because those voters have prejudices against it. We know it from the television image we have in our heads about those voters. So if we want to have useful conversations about winning the working class today, who are we talking about now? You know, how do we understand this? You know, Madani said it's the only majority. If it's the majority, what are the segments of that? And how do we think about it both in terms of labor organizing and in terms of electoral races? You know, the differences and similarities between somebody like Plattner running in Maine and Summer Lee in Pittsburgh or Rashida Tlaib. How do we view this this dilemma?
Cecil Roberts, longtime president of the United Mine Workers, and he just retired this year, would say to me all the time, if you're a leader and no one's behind you, you're just going out for a walk by yourself. And another mentor of mine said, if you were wondering if the membership's behind you, you should probably look ahead because they're ahead of you. And so I think that what we need to be thinking about is leaders who understand that the working class, the voters in this country are way ahead of the leaders who are in place. And if you want to be a leader, you better run fast to catch up with the voters and catch up with the needs of the working class. And that's really, I think, the disconnect here is that we're not even where people are. I was in a discussion about AI policy in DC, and it was the most insane discussion about like what we needed to do and how we were going to possibly like create policy that was going to work for everyday people. And I was like, oh, look at what's happening all around the country. People are rising up without any organizing, without any leadership, and saying, not in my backyard, right? And this is happening everywhere. It is organic. What we have to do is, you know, get with where the people are and form our plans and our objectives and our policies there. And that's why people who are talking about, I hate this word because it gets overused in politics, but big, bold ideas. And frankly, I don't actually think it's a big, bold idea to say that we should have a federal jobs guarantee. The tech oligarchs have said they're going to make all their money out of destroying all of our jobs. Okay, our counter is we have a federal jobs guarantee. And I don't think it's a crazy demand to say that everybody should have health care as a human right from the cradle to the grave, as Abdul El-Sayed has been saying. I think that, you know, these are very simple demands that people are already demanding. Very simple demands like, maybe I should be able to drink clean water and be able to go to sleep at night without having a data center keeping me up all night and killing my animals and making my children sick. And, you know, these are really simple things. And they're also things that working people have been fighting for since the beginning of time. You know, when we were talking about the climate crisis and there was this big idea that solving the climate crisis was going to be an attack on jobs. It was bullshit. It was the opposite, right? The climate crisis was destroying the jobs, and the solution to climate crisis was actually going to create jobs. And they also tried to pit certain jobs against others. And I think that, you know, that idea of the elite forming the party politics is a really bad idea, because that's how we ended up with things like, you know,
Trump.
Miners should just learn to code. As opposed to understanding that, you know, every single person finds their identity with their work, and we need to respect that dignity of work. That's not just about going to work, but having an identity of how you're contributing to society. People really take ownership of that, and you got to respect that and talk with people where they are and talk about how you can work together to transform your community rather than leave your community wrecked because there's no longer jobs there because they've been moved on to a place where they can do it cheaper or do it without regulations or whatever it may be. So, I mean, this is the disconnect that we don't actually have leaders who understand what regular people are going through and who understand the kind of demands that people have and are not afraid to fight for.
Sarah, this is a hard question. I'm interested to hear the answer because I really don't know. But as someone who is within the labor movement, what do you do when it feels like, there are some like actual substantive conflicts and tensions? You were just talking about that AI conversation. We've talked a lot about that on our podcast. But there are, you know, I did a debate on a different podcast with someone who was, you know, talking about the building trade support for data centers. And like, you know, of course we should, like, we need to support working class people. And that means we need to support, good contracts around these data centers versus the working class people in these rural communities who are rising up and saying, no, don't, we're going to take on these big tech billionaires. We don't want you to ruin our communities. So there are some conflicts, and some of that's like core economics. Some of that's with leadership. You know, there was just a piece today about the Teamster president, Sean O'Brien's relationship with Trump. And, you know, that's been something we've talked about a lot. So what, I don't know, how do you think about some of the actual sort of tensions that exist within the movement?
Well, I just go back to the union busters 40s, and we have to recognize that this is an attempt actually to pit working people against each other also. We also have to be honest with each other. I mean, there is no evidence that AI is actually going to deliver what these tech companies say it's going to deliver. I mean, this may be another massive bubble and crash coming, because AI doesn't actually deliver. And what these tech companies are actually speculating on is the ability to remove all jobs. So we have to be honest with each other about that. And I think that, you know, we've got to be respectful of the people who are getting work right now and not talk about them as the enemy. That's not the point. We got to hear what they're saying, and we've got to have, I know this has been overused, but we got to have a just transition for everyone. And what that means is maybe a federal jobs guarantee. It maybe means, you know, a bridge for those jobs. That has been tried not to an effect that ultimately was long lasting. But Oregon transitioning from some of the logging, there was an effort to try to keep people's income at the same level while they were bringing those jobs down and try to bridge them to something else. They didn't follow through all the way on the jobs that would be created in those communities. So it didn't ultimately work. But that's the kind of way that we've got to approach this, is to recognize, okay, what do you have today? We don't want to make your life worse. We want to make your life better. But guess what? Like, we've got to do that together, and we've got to understand our common interest here. Because what these tech oligarchs are trying to do is to pit us against each other and make us think that there's only so much of the pie and we've got to fight for this. And not only for jobs, now they're including our own safety in that. And that's, you know, that's just not true. So there are a lot of contradictions. They're on purpose. They're intended to keep us divided. They're intended to make us believe that that is going to bleed over into our politics. That's why a lot of people don't want to touch it. They don't want to go there. And that's why we're not having strategic discussions about how the labor movement can take on these tech oligarchs together and create regulation and policy that will make this an industry that is the safest, that has the best labor provisions, that has all of these things in place and is not just, I think we're leaving a lot on the table right now by just saying that it's creating good jobs for the moment for people who are building the data centers, that we need to keep good jobs for the people who are doing that, but also like understand the long game here about how we're gonna build a better world for all of us and spread the work and the good jobs and the good lives around before they have us in a position where we're so desperate because those jobs are taken away, and which is what's going to happen, that we're willing to accept anything. You know, Trump talked about rotating manufacturing jobs throughout the Midwest and into the South every few years so that people would be desperate and would be willing to take those jobs for less. They've said these things out loud. And so we just have to understand that there are tactics to try to control us and try to demoralize us and to try to be at odds with each other rather than taking them on.
You mentioned strategic conversations there. And earlier you mentioned the idea of a general strike. You've mentioned general strike a bunch of times in the last couple of years. Notably, I remember back in 2023, you came to Providence for our friend Aaron's rally. And you, I don't know if you remember this, but about like 30 seconds to a minute before you took the stage, you turned to me and you were like, so how far like socialist can I go here? And I was like, let it rip, I guess. And I think I blacked out, and like within 2 minutes, I swear you called for like a 2-day work week. It was incredible. And I'm pretty sure general strike came up, and this was the summer of 2023. You've mentioned it in light of Trump stripping TSA workers of collective bargaining rights. You've brought it up at No Kings protest. You brought it up on this podcast. Can we talk like a little specifically what you sort of see as the pathway to getting there, organizationally, politically, culturally, to make that a thing that we could actually be working toward within the next couple of years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, like everybody talks, the strike is our tactic. Solidarity is our power. So I want to just like have a baseline there. Okay.
Right.
The idea of the general strike is about waking up to our power. Mother Jones said the capitalists say there is no need of labor organizing, except the fact that they themselves are continually organizing shows us their real beliefs. And she also said that if labor were to hold up and stop working, the capitalists would yield to any and all demands because the world could simply not go on. So it's really more of a posture and an understanding of our power that we need to be talking about this. When we talk about the idea of a general strike, everything stops. But what does it stop for? So back to that whole formula about defining the problem and setting our demands. What are our demands for a general strike? I mean, I think that, you know, the people of Minnesota did a really good job of setting a list of demands. When they started to build towards the idea of a general strike, it was, you know, and there were some striking, but it was really more, you know, mass action in the streets, which is, you know, part of laying the groundwork for all of that. But they had clear demands for that action. And so that's where we have to start. What are our demands? Because people have to know why they're taking action, what they're taking action for. And I got to say, you know, as the president of the flight attendant union, I have been to a lot of picket lines and a lot of union meetings, And for example, in 2019, when I was on the picket line with GM strikers in Texas, I asked them what they were doing out there. And I could have been at a flight attendant union meeting. It was wild. I was like, you know, we may use slightly different words for this, but we've all got the same issues.
We all got the same issues.
Yeah. And so
I'm sure if you came to an actors union meeting, you'd be like, oh, damn. Wow.
Exactly. Actually, I have. And I've heard the same issues, you know, when yeah, I was exactly. out there with SAG and the Writers Guild. And,
sure.
And so I've heard these same issues everywhere. And I also know that, yeah, I represent the flight attendants and we have very, maybe unique issues in our job and we call it specific things. But I also know, I learned a long time ago that there's no way that I can possibly be the union president that they want me to be without joining hands with the rest of the labor movement and building power with other workers and making those connections. Because fundamentally, we every time we go to the table over healthcare, we are bargaining to just hang on to what we had yesterday. We're not actually going to be where we need to be until we get Medicare for all. That's what my members want. Whether they say those specific words or not, when they identify that as a priority in bargaining, that's what they're saying. And our pensions were taken away. So we've got to fight for Social Security and expand it. Yeah, I mean, these are very, very clear demands. We negotiate over commuting to work. Many flight attendants cannot afford to live in the cities that we fly out of. We fly out of these major hubs, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Dallas, Atlanta. These and it's always expensive places to live. So a lot of times flight attendants will commute by air to work. So we negotiate these commuter clauses so you don't get in trouble if your flight's late or whatever. But really what that fight is about is affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So these big ideas are our demands, I think, and those are starting to crystallize as we're defining these problems. Who would have thought that the first congressional district in Montana, the biggest issue there would be affordable housing? In Montana, for God's sakes, you know, but that is the big issue that Sam Forstag is taking on. And that is the issue that may carry him to win that district in Montana that hasn't been held by a Democrat in a very long time. So, you know, I think that our demands are becoming more and more clear, and that is what will lead to at least the idea of a general strike. We have to oftentimes, I know that, you know, that management will agree to a deal when the risk becomes too great. And you don't know how close you are to actually making them make that assessment. But if you just harken back to where we started at the beginning of this podcast about those national strikes and general strikes in cities that gave FDR the power to sign into law the New Deal and had those corporations begging for labor law because they needed some way to have some stability and maintain their business, that was that they were assessing that risk. And we made that risk too great for them. And so they decided to come to the table and agree to something that worked for everyone. And that is when we had the greatest amount of shared prosperity in this country. That's the kind of dynamic we need to organize for again. And that's why I keep talking about a general strike, because people need to understand their power, even as we're defining these problems in order to set our demands. So we're backing up those demands with what we're willing to do. And that is stop everything until they agree to it.
Let's go.
Hell yeah.
Sarah, do you want to tell us briefly about, or not briefly, it's up to you, about the organizing that that you guys are doing right now with Delta flight attendants?
Yeah, sure. So the airline industry is highly unionized, 80% unionized, but Delta Airlines decided in the 1940s, after the pilots had organized in the 30s, that they were not going to allow any other union busting on the property. They are the lowest percentage of union workers in the airline industry, and flight attendants are among them. So there's 30,000 Delta flight attendants, and they are organizing for their union under the Railway Labor Act. They have to sign physical cards that are only good for a year, and there has to be a majority of the workforce represented. So Delta will pad the list, so we've got to make sure that we actually have well more than 50% of those cards signed in order to file for an election.
Physical cards?
Physical cards. So,
And yes. Your workers are obviously across the country.
Yeah. This is not a single workplace. And also, when the campaign started really revving up, Delta changed where you report. So now you only only have to report at the airplane, not in the office. So there's no central place where even people go through. So they've made it as difficult as possible, not to mention the fact that they have the, of the major carriers, they have the highest attrition rate. They're, you know, hiring at a regular speed. But I will say this, there that we used to have new hires, it would take them about 2 years to experience working without a contract, have something go wrong before they finally are like, maybe we need a union. We have workers coming out of training now. And these are people that Delta has hired. They have scoured their social media. They have tried to find people who are not supportive of unions, but they can't do it because there is such a desire for unions in this country. And so we have people coming right out of training, signing those union cards, not being afraid to walk up to the union table. And we are getting very close to a union election. And so if people want to have a big win in the South, Delta is based in Atlanta, headquartered in Atlanta. You know, help us organize at Delta, and people can go to deltaafa.org to get a supporter pack. You can wear a button on your flight, help to make it natural to talk about a union in the workplace where Delta tries to say that that's illegal in some way. Actually, that's illegal what they're doing. But if we make this a national effort and all working people understand this is the next campaign, big campaign that we can win. Winning begets winning is what Jane McAlevey used to say, the great organizer.
And rest in peace, rest in power.
And we can win big this year. We're that close. They've got great organizing going on, and everyone listening and watching can help. So again, deltaafa.org to get your supporter pack. And if you know a Delta flight attendant, make sure that their card is up to date. And if their card is up to date, make sure they have a union pin on. And if they have their union pin on, make sure they're calling a union organizer to get even more involved, because we're going to win and we're going to organize a contract at the carrier that made more profits last year than the rest of the industry combined. So that's all of our time and all of our money at stake here. We can win big in the South. Help us out and encourage Delta flight attendants as they're organizing their union.
Let's go. That was also textbook escalating organizer ask there. That was take notes, everybody. Also, this should be like the new Starbucks. This should be like what you're interested in. If you're like a, you know, Johnny come lately hipster to the labor movement, which is awesome. Delta is the game. Like, get involved.
That's right.
Wear it.
Awesome. Love it.
One question. A while ago, I remember there was a piece, I think in The Nation, the host of this podcast, that talked about, wouldn't it be amazing if someone like Sarah Nelson ran for president in 2028? And I texted it to you and you responded just oi, period. So I don't want to, we don't want to cause you any agita on that front, but in general, would be interested to hear if you have thoughts on 2028. We're not like a horse race kind of podcast, but if you have thoughts on like what is the, whether you want to name particular names or not, I mean, again, we'd all be excited if someone like you were going to ever do it. But do you have thoughts on like, what's sort of the kind of figure that is needed in this moment for the Democratic Party?
You know, I think that it's interesting because I do actually get that question a lot. And like, it's sort of like mind boggling and mind blowing to get that question. And also it's very easy to dismiss, right? But I think that the reason that I get that question is back to the idea that people are starved for leadership. They want people that they can trust. They want people who can identify with them. They want people who they can see are real and feel empathy. And, you know, I do think that we have leaders out there who are doing that. And I do think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is doing all the right things to, if she were to decide to make that decision, that she's building the kind of support and outreach and recognition. She's going into spaces that are uncomfortable and having conversations with people who maybe don't even like her, which is exactly what we have to do as union organizers. And so I think, you know, watch what she's doing, because I think that that is the kind of leadership that is necessary here. She's also really darn good at defining the problems and setting the demands that she's hearing. She can also talk about her own personal struggle in a way that people can connect with. And so I'm not here to put pressure on her either. that's the kind of leadership that we need. We need people who understand that we cannot just be talking with the people who we think agree with us. We have to be building majority. And that means going into spaces that are uncomfortable. That means finding the connections with people who we think that we have nothing to connect with. And that's just what we need for 2028. We need people who are going to bring us together with true solidarity, working class solidarity, not just this idea that everybody has to fall in line. That is not solidarity. And so solidarity is coming out for someone else's fight because you care about your neighbors. And I think about the people who are being indicted right now in Minnesota for literally for loving their neighbors. That's why they're being arrested and persecuted, in my view. And so it's very clear that people want unity. And the final thing I'll just say is, like, yeah, these are ideas that I can espouse as a union leader. And we're talking about, you know, big national figures just now and people who are going to run for president of the United States. But frankly, as a flight attendant, as like a working flight attendant, this is something that we see every single day, every single flight that we board. Every passenger that comes to the door of our airplane, virtually every single one of them, wants a safe, uneventful flight. And usually they're really helpful to the people around them. They see the mother trying to bring on two kids and offer help. They see the elderly woman who has a hard time putting her bag up and immediately do that. They, you know, they make space for each other. That's really who we are. And that's what working people know. And so I think that's why people are really actually very interested in having a rank and file working class person run for president, because we've tried everything else. And if we, you know, want to have a country that is reflective of the people in it, then we want to have a leader who can identify and empathize and understand what it's like to live as a regular everyday person in this country.
Thank you. Our last question.
And by the way, let me say one other thing, Aaron. I would back Bernie if he decided to run. And I will tell you, every single place that I go with Bernie Sanders, and I'm not saying that he is considering this. I think he's setting up the rest of us to lead. But everywhere that I go, there is so much love for that man. because he loves us. And it's just very clear. I think he's the most important politician of our time. And he has made unions popular. He has made the possibility of working people taking control in this moment of crisis. And I just think that we owe a lot to Bernie Sanders and Jane Sanders for creating space for all of us to take ownership of our world.
It is a great tragedy of our time that this is the moment when he would when he is the right person, the right history, the right figure, the right voice, and just, you know, timing. it sucks. I really appreciate framing that David Sirota has put out of Bernie as like Barry Goldwater, as like this figure that ran for president, did not win, but really, like, in all the worst possible ways, set the stage for the conservative revolution that followed and ultimately won the debate for decades in America, in an America that we are still living in, sort of Barry Goldwater's fucked up vision, and Bernie as sort of the
antidote,
people's positive antidote to that, in the same way that his vision that the next generation that he's supporting is moving forward is going to win the day. Hopefully in the coming decades that he made possible. As I was saying, our last question is always looking around the world today. What is it that makes you most fearful and what is it that makes you the most hopeful right now?
I'm not going to say I don't have fears, but whenever I have fears, I always identify them as the union buster at work and do my best to put them out of my mind. And it's true that fear is something that is not happening. It's something that you're afraid is going to happen. So I would rather deal with the here and now and what we can do about it, because fear paralyzes, and it is one of the greatest tools of the union buster. So I am just going to say that I encourage everyone to try to reject that and recognize that that's the union buster at work. And if we can do that, and we can see the strength in other people, and understand that we're not alone, then I think that this is a moment where people are waking up. And I've never, ever, ever seen a time when people are so clear about which side we're on. And we do need leaders to help call everyone to the same place. But the vast majority of people in this country understand that the oligarchs are not for us. They're the enemy. They are not on our side. And we are all standing on the other side. We just have to recognize it. So that's frankly what makes me the most hopeful, because I've never seen that before. I've never seen the lines be drawn so clearly. And if we can harness that and figure out how to use our power, then this is a moment that really requires solutions, really requires new problem solving that gives way to creating an entirely different economy that actually can work for everyday people. So that's what makes me hopeful. And the fact that we see sparks of this all over the place, and back to the Andor reference, you know, the small acts of insurrection everywhere. And that's talking about fighting against the Empire. So, but the small acts of rebellion and against the status quo is what we should say, are popping up everywhere. We're seeing evidence of that everywhere. We're seeing it in union strikes. We're seeing it in union members running for Congress. We're seeing it in people calling for leaders that are not, you know, the traditional character of what we would think a leader is, being educated at Harvard or Yale. You know, I get that question about running for president, and people like don't even say it ironically. They're saying it like sincerely. And I just think that that is people recognizing that there is leadership everywhere, and there is leadership in people who are working class people on the shop floor, solving problems every single day. And that's the kind of spirit that we need in our leadership leading this country. So that's what makes me hopeful.
That's awesome.
Amen to that.
Thanks, Sarah. Silence your inner union buster, coming to bookstores near you.
Maybe.
It's a great. Just throwing it out there. Also, I'm in for the Nelson campaign, provided you also have a platform plank of mandatory restaurant service, because I think it's a great idea. It's a great platform.
Yes, instead of serving in the military, we're going to have people serving in restaurants. Yes, I love it.
Yeah, people talk about like a national service program, but that would probably create a lot more empathy and understanding. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Sarah. We were expecting
this would be great, and as always, you've exceeded expectations. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much. One last shout out to everybody. Check out unionnow.org and watch Andor.
one of my best friends just had a baby and named him Cassian. I bet there's gonna be a whole generation of Cassian fighters.
A whole
coming
slip
up.
Of Cassians. I love it. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sarah.
Take care.
Thank you.
Solidarity forever.
The Fighting Fascism podcast is produced by Nick Damitz in collaboration with The Nation. Music by Horseradish. Questions, comments, concerns, email us at fightingfascismpod@gmail.com.
And someday people will pick the flowers. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Someday people will pick the flowers.